Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard today's Sunday special here, Human Events Daily, the state of New York versus Donald Trump. We're doing something a little different today for the Sunday special because we've got for you a fatal four-way: Raheem Kassam, Darren Beatty, Kash Patel, and Julie Kelly all joining us to discuss this case, why it's coming, the other cases, and why the Department of Justice is purging patriots in this country as we speak. Strap in, folks. You're going to love this.
I want to take a second to remind you to sign up for the POSO Daily Brief. It is completely free. It'll be one email that's sent to you every day. You can stop the endless scrolling, trying to find out what's going on in your world. We will have this delivered directly to you, totally for free. Go to humanevents.com/POSO. Sign up today. It's called the POSO Daily Brief. Read what I read for show prep. You will not regret it. Humanevents.com/POSO. Totally free. The POSO Daily Brief.
All right, we are joined now by Raheem Kassam, the editor-in-chief of the National Pulse, as well as the writer of a popular Substack, who has just come from New York City, where he stood and took part in the protest of the potential indictment of President Trump, and we are recording this on Wednesday for everyone's edification. So as of right now, the indictment seems to be delayed. But Raheem, I wanted to ask you about, you know, your overall sense of why this is happening now, the timing, et cetera. But also, I just got to ask you first, what was the energy like there in New York on the ground?
Yeah, do you know what? I think the writer of a popular Substack is, I mean, all Substacks are popular now. I'd want to be the writer of an unpopular Substack from now on, if you don't mind introducing me like that. I went to New York to gauge the mood on the ground. You know, this is 24 hours after people are starting to get their real heads around the fact that a former president of the United States, let alone the 45th president of the United States, was, you know, imminently going to be arrested. And of course, all of the immediate sort of rancor on the right was sort of at ourselves, like, don't protest, don't go anywhere, don't do anything, just sit down and shut up while the state continues to I won't go further with that analogy, but do some pretty bad stuff to you. And I thought, well, Gavin and the New York Young Republicans, Gavin Wax and the New York Young Republicans are putting something on. Let me go and see what it's like. And look, did they have the hugest numbers? No, but everyone was vetted. Everything was safe. Everything was secure. You knew who everybody in that crowd of about 100 people were. There were about 400 journalists, by the way, that turned up. And the journalists were very angry. They were very angry that they didn't think there were enough of the Young Republicans to stage an insurrection. I don't know what an insurrection in downtown Manhattan would have looked like, perhaps, you know, raiding one of the bank's headquarters or something. But no, they were very upset. So they targeted them by saying, oh, nobody showed up for this protest, blah, blah, blah. Actually, to turn 100 people out on a Monday night at 6 p.m. in downtown Manhattan, right, in the courthouse area of Manhattan, was pretty good. It was pretty good knowing that they'd all been vetted. So I think it was more to show that, hey, you know, 100 people were started in Zuccotti Park in 2009, and they learned, and they grew, and they learned, and they grew. And I think if the left has taught the right anything...
And that was, for folks who don't get the reference, that was the start of Occupy Wall Street.
Yes, sorry. And you know, they, whether we like it or not, Occupy changed the world. And, you know, I think you have to start small at certain points for lots of good reasons, by the way, Ray Epps being one of them. But yes, it was good to see... Yeah, just as a conclusion, it was good to see, and it was good for people to know that there are people out there doing that heavy lift of making sure that other people are safe for when they do feel that direct action is needed.
100%. Now, so you know, peacefully and patriotically, right? And the sense of it, though, we've got Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin meeting in Moscow. This is the inverse of Nixon's trip to China, where the alliance is being formed. He's saying this is the Xi Jinping said declared this is the change that we have not seen in 100 years. So the realignment is taking place around the world. Meanwhile, we're completely chasing our tail. Why is this happening right now? Why go after Trump now? Why indict him now?
What I perceive as a multitude of reasons, but the, you know, Kamala Harris likes to talk in Venn diagrams, so maybe we should talk in Venn diagrams. But they all hone in on this one thing, right? Which is that he doesn't seem to be getting less popular, right? Like
right.
Everything.
We keep telling you to stop listening to that music. Why won't you turn it off?
Right. Every time, everything, every month, every week, every story, every turn of the screw, he doesn't seem to be getting less popular. The numbers are telling them time and time again. It doesn't seem. So what do we do? Well, we have to do something. What if you're Ron DeSantis? What do you do? You have to do something. For whatever you've done so far, he doesn't seem to be getting less popular and doesn't seem to be losing that front runner status. And actually, in the last couple of weeks, seems to have picked up numbers in the primary polling that we've been looking at. And I look across the board. You know, I look at the very fake news polls because it's important to know your enemy as much as it is to know your friends. And I look at the polls that I think have better weighting to them and better methodologies, like the Rasmussen data and so forth. And he doesn't seem to be getting less popular. And so I think all of this is converging on that frustration, that they've got this huge frustration right now that, okay, well, if we cannot beat him, we're going to beat him, right? Like, if we cannot beat him fair and square, we are going to beat him unfair and unsquare. It's the same playbook, by the way. It's just ratcheted up. It's dialed up. It feels hotter being part of a primary process, right? Especially when you've now got a Republican who's willing to sort of echo a lot of their talking points as well. So this is the fight, by the way, that Donald Trump wants. It's the fight. It's the type of fight Donald Trump thrives in. And I think you're only going to see him getting more popular, not less, as a result of it.
Raheem, do you see something, you know, and I've been tweeting this and it's going quite viral, but, you know, I want to see if you look at it this way as well, where this question of war, this question of America's standing in the world, the fact that he is the only president in modern history to not start a new war, the fact that he's the only president on the stage saying, I will end the Ukraine war in 24 hours if you put me back in, I will be this negotiator. It seems like the system is responding to that. And whether or not it's specifically about the Ukraine war or may have a broader point, a higher point, that I am not the man of the system. I am the man of the people. I am the man looking to reset the system, as it were. He's upsetting a lot of apple carts, and some of those apple carts, many of which are, of course, as we've argued, deeply in bed with China. Amazon, Apple, many of these companies, they are de facto Chinese companies now. Big Pharma, they're all big de facto China because they depend on China. They depend on this relationship. Now, of course, China's gone completely off the leash. And so they're working with Russia. They're working with the global South. They're carving up the world, one belt, one road. Why go after him now, if at the same time we are trying to pivot against China? Do you know what I'm trying to say? It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's a very simple answer.
It seems like there's an alignment, but it's also an opposition.
The answer is very simple. The answer is because he would have been at that meeting. Like,
yeah,
you know,
sure, exactly.
Major power,
right? He'd be there.
The major powers are carving up, you know, geopolitically and geostrategically, a functionally important area, if you know your, you know, world island theory. And you think Donald Trump, as the president of the United States, A, wouldn't have muscled his way into that room and into that and at that negotiating table, and B, dragged Zelensky along with him and said, if I'm sitting through this and we're going through this for you, then you're sitting here and conversing as well. And we are going to figure out how to end this very quickly. That's what would have happened. And yes, you would have. Look, I don't know what peace exactly looks like, obviously, but I think we all know sort of what it looks like, right? People are starting to realize that it looks like some of the territory going some way, and perhaps some international, you know, oversight of some other things and borders and what have you. And you can get there very quickly if you want to. The problem is, as I wrote in the Substack last year, Boris Johnson was the one telling them not to do it.
The, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month.
Yeah. And Boris Johnson was the one telling them not to do it, not to pursue a path of peace. And of course, now you're seeing the State Department and Kirby and all of these guys saying the same thing. It's amazing. It's amazing how we have moved from peace being the anathema. And that's Trump, right? Like, Trump represents that philosophy. It's a dying philosophy politically. Peace, right? There's no money in peace.
No, nobody's paying you for it. But at the same time, it's amazing to me that we have a situation. I mean, and this is why when I think about it, I just go back to the money, the millions of dollars that we know was flowing from China to the Biden family. He's their guy. He's their guy. He's their guy in the White. This is exactly what you would expect him to be doing while you're sitting there holding the meeting to carve up the world. And let's be honest. I'm going to ask Aaron Beatty about this as well. But it seems to me as though in terms of all of this, Russia is going into this alliance, whatever you want to call it, as the junior partner, because they've been forced to. They've expended so much political capital, so much economic capital that, okay, sure, you get your pieces of Ukraine and you get your access to the Black Sea and the Mediterranean through Syria, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, your status on the global stage is forever changed.
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't think Russia really particularly cares about that, because they're a junior partner to a global power in the ascendancy as a result of that power's exploitation of, you know, America, of American jobs, of favored trade status, of American politics, of, you know, American idiots, you know, as Green Day once called them, who will just nod along with the party line, except the party line now comes from the, you know, the Green Day side. And that was what was funny about being in New York as well, watching all of this take place and being a part of history in that sense, was that once upon a time, it was the rock and roll people and it was the punk rockers who were standing in the squares protesting the corporate state nexus. And now it's Gavin Wax and the Young Republicans.
You know, it's amazing to think about that how much shift has taken. And then it's also, too, by the way, to look at Russia. If Russia returns to the world system on China's terms, then that's it. They've run the entire table then, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That is the answer.
So they've run the table. So we are the global serfs. They are the leaders. We will bow to our Chinese masters, and everyone needs to start learning Mandarin. You should always be very suspicious of people who learn Mandarin. Raheem Kassam, where can people follow you?
Raheem Kassam on all social media, the Substack, raheemkassam.com, and of course, thenationalpulse.com.
Appreciate it. Everyone go follow.
Thanks, Jay.
All right. We are excited to welcome back here Darren Beatty of Revolver News. Now, as a reminder to everyone, we are recording this on Wednesday. It is playing on Sunday. So if any indictment does happen or has happened, we're told it's delayed. But as of right now, it has yet to happen. Darren, I got to ask you, and I was talking to Raheem about this, the timing of this is so interesting to me, because we have these massive Silicon Valley bank failures. The Fed comes in, backstops the entire thing, almost nationalizes the banking system in a sense. That happens last week. Then the Xi and Putin meeting takes place in Moscow. And suddenly, like whiplash, we're being told that President Trump is about to be indicted. Why is all of this happening so quickly?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly a lot of interesting things converging at once. I don't know how deliberate the timing is, but of course it's significant in the sense that we only have the capacity to think about and talk about so much at any one time. And some kind of manufactured, ridiculous scandal, extremely contrived in terms of what the charges are, like, you know, paying money, you know, from his own pocket. And there's some charges about, okay, this is campaign finance issue. None of it seems to stick or make any sort of sense. But the idea that should monopolize national attention when these other things are happening, we're having increasing involvement of the government into the banking sector. We're having extremely critical geopolitical realignment taking place right before our eyes. But then in another sense, it's not as insignificant as it seems, because really the indictment of Trump does represent a kind of culmination of one of the most important and dangerous trends that we've had in our politics, which is the political weaponization of our bureaucracies, from the FBI to the CIA to the DHS, all the way to the Department of Justice. And so in a weird way, this seems to be a natural and inevitable culmination of these absolutely poisonous trends in our country.
Well, you know, it's interesting because my wife, coming from the Soviet Union, actually had a point that she said to me the other day, where she said, you know, from the day they raided Mar-a-Lago, you knew this was coming, because this is how it always starts. And it doesn't matter what the charge is. It never does. It's first they raid the guy's house, then they say there's some corruption, then they say they found something, then they say there's a crime, then there's a trial, and then you never hear from him again. And she said, look, this is the same playbook that I've seen happen a million times back home. I just never thought I'd see it happen here.
Right. No, that's a great point. And to, you know, the credit of the regime, there is a tremendous vigor and persistence when it comes to punishing anyone who dares to challenge them, criticize them, mock them, expose them, subvert them. And nobody has done this to a more effective degree than Trump, who started and still leads the most powerful movement challenging the existing power structure in the regime. And so if you look at what, you know, the end game was with Assange, it's clear that that is the goal and has to be the goal from the regime standpoint. They simply can't allow someone like Donald Trump to continue to exist as a political figure, as a viable political figure, and they will throw everything they have to take him off the chessboard and to silence, suppress, and neutralize the energies associated with the historic America First movement that he began and still leads.
So what's interesting is, how do you view it then in the realignment of world politics? Because, and I said something on the show earlier this week where I said, the minute that the United States targeted Assad, right? So 2013, 2014, but was not able to unseat him, and obviously he's still in power today in Damascus, that may have marked the culmination or the tail end of American power, because this was the first time, at least on the world stage, that the globalist American empire was not able to fulfill one of its stated goals. And ever since then, what we've seen is a recoiling of American power, to which the America First movement seems to almost be a response to, because Trump and many others are looking at the situation saying, why do we need this global empire? Why don't we just be dominant in our region, maintain our manufacturing base, restore our country, and forget about being the world police?
Well, that's an excellent point, and it really harkens back to the beginnings of the Trump movement, when the whole Syria issue was a very live, hot button question in our geopolitics. And of course, Hillary Clinton was front and center in the whole affair. Hillary Clinton, who, you know, essentially, I wouldn't say murdered, but she's certainly a major figure in the death of Gaddafi. The question is, you know, why didn't Assad get the Gaddafi treatment? Does that represent some kind of weakness? It certainly represents the defeat of, you know, the Hillary Clinton faction of the security apparatus. But then on the other hand, you could say they're largely getting their way when it comes to Ukraine. And how important was, you know, Syria was important because it was the intersection of a lot of things. There was the proxy war basically between Saudis and Iranians, which is now, there's basically a peace deal brokered by China, of all countries, between the Saudis and Iranians. But back then, Syria was very much part of that proxy war, and also of the kind of proxy conflict with Russia, the US and Russia. And so now Syria has kind of died down as a hotbed of the proxy war, and the locus has moved very dramatically to Ukraine. And so you have a lot of the people who maybe didn't get their way in Syria kind of getting their way in the Ukraine. But I do think that just symbolically, Assad is an interesting figure in that he's kind of stood up to challenge the globalist American empire and kind of lived to tell the tale, and almost to the point where there's this meme now of the Assad curse, is that, you know, anybody who makes it a point to go after Assad, you know, gets the boomerang blowback effect and something bad happens to them.
Assad must go. Who must go?
Exactly. Right? You know, exactly.
I believe Boris Johnson, Theresa May, Liz Truss, Jacinda Ardern, the list goes on.
Right. No, it's a remarkable thing he's doing. He does well for an ophthalmologist or whatever his formal training is. But I think at this point, you know, the fundamental loci of sort of geopolitical concern moved. It's obviously, you know, Ukraine is one of them now. It's a question whether that's actually a priority, but it's certainly a priority from the standpoint of, you know, the regime, certain factions in the regime. And then obviously,
well, actually, let me, because we only have a couple of minutes left, let me ask you though, and you've teased this out before, I think you were the first one to really presage it, that with the destruction of Nord Stream 1 and 2, that the disconnection of Russia from Europe, the fact that they've now been driven into the arms of China, not necessarily by choice, but by matter of necessity, does it then follow that with this meeting, Russia is not necessarily coming out of this as the senior partner or even a peer partner in this? This is not a joint partnership. They are the junior partner to China because they are forced to be.
Absolutely. And, you know, to be fair, just, you know, it is interesting how well Russia is able to punch above its weight geopolitically. I would say that's largely attributable to the skill, Putin's skill and leadership, at least until the Ukraine issue, which in my view was a profound blunder on Putin's part. But at least until then, Putin was extremely good at kind of making us forget how insignificant Russia's economy is. Like, people, you know, who aren't really schooled in, you know, geopolitics, it's, you can think that Russia and China are kind of countries that should be at parity to some degree, when really, economically speaking, they're not even in the same league, far from it.
Which Putin himself admitted at the meeting.
Right.
He actually admitted, right, we are envious of your growth.
Right. And so for that reason, Russia always, despite itself, maybe it would be tough for them to acknowledge because of their stature, you know, in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but they're always going to be some kind of junior partner. But the self-inflicted wound of the Ukraine operation and the sort of global cancellation of Russia, if you will, really put them in a far weaker position than even they could have anticipated. And so now China really holds all the cards, far more leverage than it would have had otherwise. And so this really, that's their only option. It's Russia's only option. And so China, of course, benefits from this the most, relatively speaking.
Yeah, we'll get them back next time, I guess. It seems to be the way. And of course, Xi Jinping is going to is heading to Moscow. He's giving him face. They hold a meeting there rather than Beijing because it doesn't matter for him. He's gotten everything that he wants. He's getting all the access to Russia. They're going to get that fuel from Siberia. The pipelines are going to be coming down. The fuel is going to be flowing across Lake Baikal and all of those eastern, those far eastern Siberian pipelines that are going to be built direct. And what's directly south of Siberia? Oh, right, Beijing. So it's immediately there.
Right.
So they're going to be getting the fuel from Russia. And I look at it from that perspective and I say, what would it take then to even break this up at this point? Because Europe doesn't seem like they're open in even the slightest to a reopening of Nord Stream, to a reconnection of economies. I mean, if any American, if Trump becomes president again or anyone, is looking to isolate or break up Russia and China, they're going to have a huge, huge way to go from here to there.
Yes, I think further cooperation between Russia and China is pretty much inevitable. There are some natural tensions that have always existed between the two, but now with Russia severely weakened without really any bargaining power to speak of. They will simply have to accept their fate as a very, very junior partner under the Chinese umbrella. And that's basically the geopolitical future that we wrote for them. You know, it didn't have to be that way, but it's hard to imagine how that could fundamentally change at this point.
No, that's exactly right. Darren Beatty, where can people follow you? What are your coordinates?
At Darren J. Beatty at Twitter and revolver.news, revolver.news. We've got the latest on the Trump indictment and the meme trial of the Doug Mackey, young guy facing 10 years in prison for mocking Hillary Clinton in a meme. So we've got it all, the very latest, revolver.news.
Now, make sure you're following that, everyone. If they can get, they can set the precedent that memes are criminal, then guess what? They're going to come after all of us. Thanks again, Darren.
Thank you.
All right. We are very excited to welcome to Human Events Daily here on our Sunday special, Kash Patel. Now, folks, I want to remind everybody that we are pre-taping this. We usually do pre-tape our Sunday specials, but of course, because we're in the fog of war when it comes to all this, just for your edification, for as a programming note, we are recording this on Thursday of this week. So if anything changes, we're not going to be able to comment on that. But as of today, we just heard the DA Alvin Bragg has canceled the grand jury for the rest of the week. As we said before, it doesn't sound like he has the goods. Kash, you are a former federal prosecutor. You've been involved in grand juries before. Is this normal? Is this how grand juries normally operate? What's going on?
Hey, Jack, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show. Look, you know, in my time as a national security prosecutor, and I think more relevant here is my time as a federal public defender, being on the defense of these matters. Grand jury stuff is supposed to be pretty silent. Of course, we're beyond those days. Now things leak when it's convenient to the radical left. But let's look at it procedurally. Grand juries are about 20 to 30 people from your community who are on the call basically for 6 to 8 months at a time. And they are told ahead of time to change their life schedules to come in because you as the prosecutor wants to present them evidence to say, hey, I've got stuff you need to hear and see and listen to, and you then need to make a decision-making process. Remember, everybody keeps saying Alvin Bragg isn't going to charge Donald Trump. It's not Alvin Bragg's decision. He and his prosecutors make the presentation of the evidence, and they call in these grand jurors. But what's rare is when you have a grand jury called in, because you're pulling in people from all over New York City, telling them don't go to work, stop that child daycare, and all your other family matters and commitments and come in here and decide whether or not we have enough evidence to charge. And all they need is 51 to 49. If you look at it on a scale, it's not a trial with guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's maybe did it happen? So for Alvin Bragg to now say all of a sudden, he not just canceled one day, but the entire week of grand jury testimony means from a prosecutorial standpoint, he's got a lot of problems with the evidence he wanted to present and didn't. And from a defense standpoint, we now know that he suppressed evidence from this grand jury thanks to Costello's testimony and the letter from Michael Cohen's former attorney over at Wilmer, whatever the law firm is.
So when you're looking at it in terms of the procedure, right. Let's say the indictment comes down. I mean, how does it work from there? Does President Trump have to go to New York? Does he have to turn himself in there? Can he go to Florida? Is there some extradition? People are asking, would Governor DeSantis be involved? Does he have to be handcuffed? Who makes all those decisions?
Yeah, let's take those in reverse. So in terms of extradition, because it's state court charge, it's good to remind people that we're not dealing with federal court here. We're dealing with New York City state level courts. If Donald Trump challenged the extradition, then Florida Governor Ron DeSantis would have to get in since Donald Trump is a resident of the state of Florida. But from what my understanding is, Donald Trump was not planning on ever challenging, you know, this.
I've heard that as well, by the way.
So we skip that. And then we get to Alvin. It's up to Alvin Bragg. You know, look, how many prosecutions and defense matters were handled over the last 3 years via Zoom because of COVID? And then that practice continued. So they could conceivably, and it would be smart from a security posture standpoint, if Donald Trump's indicted, why would you want a wild scenario to unfold where people might get hurt? I know why politically those against Donald Trump would want that to happen so they can say he's up to another sort of insurrection of the sorts. But Alvin Bragg can avoid all that. And he probably will choose not to do it if he indicts it, because he wants to almost what we call perp walk, the handcuffs on Donald Trump down Broadway. He wants the Hollywoodization of it like the left always does. And, you know, you're the political genius on this stuff. I don't know if that's helpful or hurtful. I think Donald Trump would probably find a way to make that beneficial to his standpoint like he has. But he's put the justice system on defense. From my perspective, that's almost impossible to do. You're talking about a guy who was 100% going to be indicted. And now people that dislike Donald Trump are saying publicly what prosecutorial overreach Alvin Bragg is doing here. And then you're talking about members in Congress who not necessarily like Donald Trump who are saying, we can't have this weaponization at the state level either. It's a shocking turn of events.
How do you feel about, so that's the New York case. How do you feel about some of these other cases that are out there? Because let's say the New York case doesn't stick the landing, which it, as we record this, it seems like that's where we are. That being said, I mean, they could vote on Monday, it could come out, he'd be indicted, et cetera. But if this, let's just hypothetical, right? And they always say, you know, don't ask a hypothetical in court. let's say this one doesn't come in, can't stick the landing. Does that affect the decision to prosecute down in Georgia? Does it affect the decision of Merrick Garland, essentially, because he has that grand jury up in, and actually, as far as I know, there's actually two grand juries in Washington, D.C. There's one on classified documents. There's another on January 6th. But ultimately, right. I think we know that Merrick Garland is kind of pulling the strings here. Does it affect his decision-making process, do you think, if this one completely falls apart, as it seems to have been doing this entire week?
From an evidentiary standpoint, since they're unrelated, no. But we've gone are the days where prosecutors in Merrick Garland's DOJ and Chris Wray's FBI just bring cases based on facts and law. They have completely weaponized it. So I do think politically, it does come into their calculations. And let's remember, the New York State Attorney General refused to prosecute Donald Trump on the Alvin Bragg case. The DOJ refused to prosecute Donald Trump on the Alvin Bragg case. So it has some windfall, waterfall effects as it cascades down the line. Now, Georgia is a completely different set of facts. And whether or not this the prosecutor down there is willing to bring the case, he's probably looking at New York and saying, well, they had a slam dunk. And now they're gone the 1 yard line instead of at the other end of the field, instead of in the end zone. And it looks like they might not bring that case at all. So there may be that political calculation. But I think the facts and evidence are entirely different down in Georgia. And they're still going to try to get Trump. And if they can't get Trump, they're going to try to get someone in close to Trump's universe. And that's what I've always suspected the Georgia matter was about. They'll try to get into Trump's inner circle with charges related to that, and not necessarily Donald Trump.
Cash, why go through this all now? I mean, doesn't it? Because at the end of the day, right, so you asked me what I thought about the calculation of it. You know, I think Trump as a bad boy is kind of, it's priced into his image. It's part of his, it's part of his marketing, in a sense, where, you know, we remember Trump from the 80s and 90s, hanging out ringside with Mike Tyson, you know, building skyscrapers in mob-controlled neighborhoods, right? That's always been part of his persona. So for the machinations of the system to be completely against him. Well, guess what? That's always been what he said all along. It makes it look like everything that he said about the deep state, it was 100% true. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to go over to those moderates, people who may not normally, as you say, may not normally be, you know, big Donald Trump fans, and to say, you know what, maybe that was the truth. Because look, even Chris Rock pointed this out. You know, you put one of these guys, put 50 Cent in jail, he comes out, he does what, 5 platinum records, right? You know, for a lot of these guys, it's very helpful for them. I remember, Steve won't like me talking about this, but when Steve was on trial in Washington, D.C., War Room went to the number one podcast in America with, you know, a certain extremely handsome and very intellectual guest host running the entire thing. But it wasn't really because of that. It was because he was on trial. It's because everyone wanted to know what was going on. And we did cover it, by the way. We led with it every day. And so I think the calculation on their part is actually backwards, because I think it's going to completely backfire and they have to be realizing this.
I think you're right. And I think they initially thought, nope, we are going to be the ones that get Donald Trump. Remember, it started with Russiagate and Adam Schiff and then Eric Swalwell and then everybody else after it. Ukraine impeachment one and two, Fiona Hill, Vindman, Charmella. Those were hoaxes. January 6th, everything in between, COVID origins, Fauci, everybody was going to get Trump. And Alvin Bragg stepped up to the plate and said, nope, I'm going to be the guy that gets Trump. I'm going to make up basically facts and charges along the way to do so. And we've called him out on it and hide evidence of innocence from the grand jury. And I can tell you from a grand jury perspective, if I was one of the 30 people sitting on that grand jury and I found out now that the prosecutor hid the evidence that Costello shows that contradicts Michael Cohen's testimony, I'd be pretty ticked off. So, you know, we've seen, unfortunately, the two-tier system of justice unfold at the federal, state, and local levels now across America. And what I've told the president repeatedly is, you know, if we put aside the politics of it, we have an opportunity here to educate everybody who thought we were the conspiracy guys, saying when Steve Bannon was prosecuted, when you were investigated during Russiagate or the classified docs case, saying it was a two-tier system of justice. We have a chance to show everybody we were right then, we're right now.
Cash, I got to ask you, you know, final question. What's it like to have been behind the number one single in America, not just on Apple iTunes, but on Billboard number one? I'm looking at this now. How did that happen?
You know, we're blessed to be in a free speech area with Truth Social and Rumble and have such wonderful Americans like yourself pounding so hard on the Jan 6 mission because so many people have been mistreated. And we sort of galvanized all that and said, how do we help them? Created this song, spent no money, recorded the January 6 prisoners themselves singing the national anthem, and then Donald Trump lent his voice with the Pledge of Allegiance. We combined it, added music, and we said, hey, let's raise money for the families. Let's put it out there. We don't need the big industry labels. We just need free speech platforms. And it's the third number one song release on Truth Social. John Rich had two of them before that, and now we have this one. And, you know, I think the music industry is imploding. And I'm just happy we were able to knock off Taylor Swift and Miley Cyrus from their number one statuses. But I'm more happy that we were able to raise awareness and talk about due process for January 6th defendants, so many of whom have just been crushed by the weaponization of the DOJ. And we're going to be in a position to financially help a lot of them, which is just great. So j6prisonchoir.com, keep it number one. The fact that we're number one on Billboard, I'm telling you, as you know, the music industry in Hollywood is having a nuclear meltdown.
Amen. Cash Patel, thank you so much for joining us. Where should people go to follow you, get all the latest?
Thanks so much. I'm on Truth Social at Cash, at KASH, and fightwithcash.com has everything about me. Fightwithcash with a K.com. And grab my new book, Government Gangsters. The information is at governmentgangsters.com. It's on pre-sale now.
All right, Cash Patel. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we are back. Today is Thursday. We're still on pre-record, so we don't know yet if the indictments are handed. It doesn't look like they'll be handed down by Sunday, but I'm just throwing it out there to make sure that you guys understand as a programming note. We're very excited to welcome, though, to the program here, Human Events Daily, Miss Julie Kelly, the great Julie Kelly. Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Jack. Thanks so much for having me.
So we've been talking predominantly about these cases or potential cases against President Trump. You are, I would say, the foremost expert, though, on the January 6 cases. And I've also, of course, this week been talking about the case against Douglas Mackey. It was this pro-Trump meme guy in 2016. There's a meme trial against him going on. Can you walk us through why is it that this is going on right now? And what are some of the latest things that you've even been seeing, these new tactics and just so underhanded behavior from the DOJ and FBI this week?
So the trial that I've been covering really the past few months, Jack, is the seditious conspiracy trial of five members of the Proud Boys. This includes Enrique Tarrio, who is the group's leader. So they were charged with seditious conspiracy. Four of the men have been held under pretrial detention orders, meaning denied bail, for 2 years as the court proceedings dragged on. Finally, the trial started in January. What the trial has revealed, even though the government and Judge Tim Kelly have tried desperately to keep all of this information under wraps is the presence of at least 10 to 15 FBI informants embedded in the Proud Boys months before January 6th. But the real bombshell that came out this week is that the prosecutors at the last moment notified the defense. The government wrapped up their case in chief on Monday after 9 weeks. It's now the defense attorney's turn. The government notified the defense attorneys on Wednesday afternoon that one of their defense witnesses, who was going to take the stand on Thursday, actually also has been an FBI informant for almost the entirety of the investigation, from April of 2021, shortly after the first charges were filed, until January 2023, when the trial began. What really was explosive, Jack, that came out in one of the defense motions is that this informant was communicating with defense attorneys, with defendants and their families, apparently even was involved in a prayer group with some of the defendants and their families, because a lot of the J6 defendants had organized these prayer groups.
So I want to be clear. I want to be clear for everybody out there that during these interactions and all of this time, this informant, it was not known to any of these people. It was unbeknownst to them. They were unwitting to have an informant in their midst. They actually ran an informant in the defense family, in their groups. Obviously, it sounds like breaking attorney-client privilege, all sorts of legal issues with this. How can we have a government that just acts this way?
Because the judges allow it. Jack, the real villains here are the federal judges, including Judge Tim Kelly, who was appointed to the bench by Donald Trump. Does not matter if these judges are appointed by a Republican or a Democratic president. They are acting as nothing more than a rubber stamp for this reckless, vengeful Department of Justice political persecution against Trump supporters. This is now a guy like Judge Tim Kelly actually is one of the worst, because he's invested in the guilt of the defendants that he has kept behind bars, away from their families, away from even their defense attorneys, deprive them of due process, freedom, et cetera. So he's invested in their conviction because he's denied their bail numerous times. None of these men have a criminal record. None of them are charged even with a violent crime. They didn't attack police officers or attack lawmakers. So he's going to do whatever he can to prove that his decision to deny these men their fundamental rights was the right one. So the judges here are really the bad guys. But of course, so are the prosecutors, because they also are held unaccountable. You know this, Jack. When they got away with everything they did in Russiagate, that was more a green light. This is now accelerated into the criminal manhunt crusade prosecution of thousands of Trump supporters. And there just still is really deafening silence out of the Republican Party. Even as we know, the total caseload is going to double as the Department of Justice, Matthew Graves, who is the DC U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, the office handling every case, has warned the courts and the public defender's office to expect up to 1,200 more cases related to January 6th.
And is it true that the new rubric that I know that some people have said that the new rubric is, even if you were on the grass, that if you didn't even go into the building, didn't climb the steps, but if you were on the grass, that technically the grass is, which by the way, you know, I'm in Washington, D.C. all the time. I've sat on that lawn for the July 4th concert that, you know, that they hold with when I brought Tanya down and we go watch the July 4th. Last time I checked, that was a public lawn. Right. So is that the new rubric?
No, it has been. It has been since day one. In fact, the first person I reported on as a political prisoner was Cui Griffin. He is the Cowboys for Trump leader. He was arrested and charged and denied bail, and he was on Capitol grounds. He never even went inside the building. Yet he faced misdemeanor charges that nonetheless resulted in his pretrial detention incarceration for several days before he was released. He never even went inside the building. Multiple defendants never went inside the building because at the last moment, even though there were permits, and we have more evidence of that that just came out last week by a long report by the DC Metro Police, anticipating where these rallies and protests were going to take place. People had permits to go to Capitol grounds and hold their rallies or their protests. But Nancy Pelosi decided the last minute to restrict the entire Capitol campus. So you do have these trespassing charges against people, except, of course, Ray Epps, if you were in the so-called restricted area outside the building at any point on January 6th. So I believe that this new wave of arrests will mostly scoop up more misdemeanor offenders, I guess if that's the right word, perhaps adding the most common felony count, which is obstruction of an official proceeding, or another common felony, which is civil disorder. But look, you've got already 8 or 9 people arrested this month alone, 26 plus months later, and there is absolutely no end in sight.
Why is it that you think they are doing all this? There's obviously so much going on. There's so much crime in Washington, D.C. on a regular basis. Why is this taken the forefront of our entire Justice Department's docket? Why are they putting so many resources behind this?
A couple of reasons, Jack. One is, I believe, successfully silencing and criminalizing political dissent. You saw the outcry last week when Donald Trump posted on Truth Social encouraging people to protest if indeed he was indicted. Suddenly, the entire national news media, Democratic lawmakers said, oh my God, he's trying to foment another insurrection. Then you had people on our side, I think, very smartly warning people not to organize and protest because of what this Department of Justice and FBI are doing to criminalize political dissent. So that's one. Number two is to build a public and legal case to justify a criminal indictment against Donald Trump, either for obstruction, conspiracy, or if these Proud Boys are convicted of seditious conspiracy, which of course they probably will be by a DC jury, that will give a legal basis to charge Donald Trump with the same count, because as you know, Jack, in the October 2020 presidential debate, when he was forced by Chris Wallace and Joe Biden to condemn the Proud Boys, he said, stand back and stand by. That has been used by the government as evidence in this trial. That the Proud Boys were taking their cues from Donald Trump. So I think those are the two biggest political and legal motivations, but also to try to explain or convince the public that Trump supporters are domestic violent extremists, domestic terrorists, and that's why they have launched, as I said in my book, a second war on terror against the political right.
It's completely insane. Julie Kelly, we're just about out of time. Let us know, where can our viewers find your information and where can they get a copy of your book?
Thanks so much for having me on. All my work is at American Greatness, amgreatness.com. I post a lot of breaking news on Twitter, Julie_Kelly2, and my book can be found on Amazon.
Folks, please go follow Julie. She is just a wealth of information. She's working 24/7. I've never seen you take a day off. I'm doing digital detox Sundays, but I've never seen you actually take a day off. Julie Kelly, God bless, and thank you for your tireless work in terms of all of this.
You too, Jack. Thanks for covering all my work and being such a good friend. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Julie, and thanks to all of our guests here today. The Human Events Sunday Special, ladies and gentlemen, as always, you have my permission to lay ashore.